loves to watch Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm interviewing the UK's king of radio, Paul Burke. And as much as, you know, I guess people might question a title like that. I mean, there isn't really a king of TV or queen of TV, really, is there? Or press or posters. I guess there's quite a few people in those royal families. But I think if you asked anyone who has been the foremost radio creative in the UK, Paul Burke's name would come up far more often than anyone else's. He has proven himself with fantastic range and quality and longevity in the medium. He writes, he directs, he produces, he does the casting as well. So, yeah, I don't think anyone can really question his position in that medium. But he's also done excellent work in other media as well. I've put some of it on the blog if you want to check it out. And you can check the link to his website as well. There's some great work there. And we also touch a little bit on his time as an author. He's written several novels. But as I said to him on the podcast, I think it would be great if he and I could perhaps take another hour at some point in the future and explore that subject separately. I'm sure there are plenty of creatives out there who have finished half a novel or three quarters of a novel or even a full novel and might like to know what happens next. And as Paul and I have both been published, we might be able to shed a little bit of light on that. So that's for a future podcast. In the meantime, without further ado, here's my chat with Paul Burke. So, Paul, thank you very much for getting up at such an early hour in London. For me, it's quite late in LA, but great for making the time. Thank you very much.
Well, I phoned in. I can't do my paper round this morning, but apart from that, I get up early anyway.
Well, yeah, it's still very kind. Yeah, so I've started all my other conversations with advertising luminaries with the same question because it seems to like kick things off a little bit. But how and why did you get into advertising?
Right. When I was at school in the sixth form, they had a thing called a careers convention. Someone had come round from the civil service or from the police or from NatWest Bank, and they talked to you about it. And I thought I wanted to be a journalist. And this bloke came round from the local paper, I remember it now. He goes, "I'm from the Wembley Observer. He's a dry old stick. I've been there for 36 years and I feel part of the community." And I'm thinking, oh my God. And then you get the line that did it for me was, "I've covered their weddings, I've covered their children's weddings." And I thought, oh no. This sounds, you know, my whole life in Northwest London, you know, what's that old thing that they say? Covering stories that say man drops bag of sugar in supermarket, we have pictures. I thought, oh no. And then someone came around from advertising, which I think at the time, the early 80s, we as a nation had heard of Saatchi and Saatchi. We didn't know anything else. And he comes around, he's probably an account man, seemed very old, probably about 28. Don't know what he was doing in my school, probably a friend of somebody's brother or something. And like a good account man, he gave a nice presentation and said it was a great business and it's, you know, full of young people. And I thought, oh, this will be good, maybe. So I got home and got the Yellow Pages. The first one was called AAP Ketchum. So I rang them, they were engaged. And the next one said Abbott, Mead and Vickers. So I phoned up and asked to speak to Mr. Abbott. And honestly, if I'd got a bit further down that yellow page, asked to Leo Burnett or Jay Walter Thompson, I have no idea who this. I probably wouldn't have asked to speak to Mr. Saatchi, weirdly, because I'd heard of them. And it was the word agency. Back in the day, they used to have what I suppose you'd call temp agencies, like Alfred Marks in the high street. And Brooks, I thought that's what this place would be. And oddly enough, people do refer to ad agencies as shops. So come and speak to Mr. Abbott, please. Secretary says here that what's called regarding, I like to work in advertising. This is true. It sounds like a lie. She says, "Are you a writer or an art director?" Now, the bloke at my school had explained what a writer was. He hadn't mentioned the word art director. So I thought, oh, I like writing. And I said, a writer. And she said, okay. And they made me an appointment and it got cancelled a couple of times, postponed rather. And I get in there, David Abbott, how do you do? And I went, hello. He said, "Where's your book?" I went, "Book?" I didn't know what he meant. And he said, you know, your portfolio, your ads. And I'm standing there in my top man's suit and my, it was white socks and maroon loafers in those days. And I was just, I turned the same colour as my loafers. And I just went, I haven't got one here. And he smiled sort of patiently. He said, but I thought you said you were a writer. I said, I didn't know what an art director was. And I wasn't trying to be cute or clever. I didn't know. And he said, oh dear. And he sat down, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. And he drew these Venn diagrams. You've got account management, you've got TV production, you've got this, you've got that. Hang on a minute. And he went outside and he said, he went to his secretary's phone, said, John? Yeah, it's David. Still looking for a runner. Got a boy here, so it seems all right. Can I bring him down? And they brought me down to the dispatch department and David Abbott said, this is John. You talk to him. It was very nice to meet you. And then John just says, when did you leave school? I said, 16th of January. He goes, can you start on the Monday? And that was it. No idea. And it seemed like a nice place. And when I got there, the coolest place in the world. The way I describe it, there was people there like Richard Foster and John Horton and Chris O'Shea, David Rossiter. They were like cool older brothers. You know, I was 18, they were probably 30. And, you know, they were into music and into, you know, just into a life I didn't really know. And I loved it from that moment onwards in Dispatch.
Would you mind telling us which year that was? You don't have to.
No, of course not. 1980. I was 18.
1980. Well, David had been already the managing director and CD of DDB like 15 years before that. And, you know, AMV had been going a little while. So the idea that he would see a random person ringing up to say, you know, here's my book, I'm a writer or whatever, is pretty crazy in this day and age.
No, exactly. I had no idea who he was. They just because it was a small place. So I'm not saying he didn't seem that impressive, but it just seemed like a little friend, which actually it was. It was just a very friendly, down-to-earth place. I was staff number 33. Wow. And when I got there, they said, have you passed your driving test? I said, yeah, oh, good, you can drive a van. And I used to drive the Abbott Mead van around sometimes. You know, I just did whatever. I was the most junior person in the entire industry. And I just did whatever anyone else told me to do. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I sort of wanted to be a writer, but not really. I actually wanted to be a cab driver because I was driving around London. But you had to be 21 to do the knowledge. And I was 18. You know, and I graduated. I thought, when I'm 21, I'll go off and do the knowledge on my moped. But on my 21st birthday, I got 6 points for a minor traffic offence. And so there was a 3-year gap before I could be a taxi driver. And by that time, I decided to be a copywriter. Oh. And it really was, well, I wouldn't say as simple as that. I think it's those rose-tinted spectacles. People always think they didn't, I didn't do any work at university. Oh, I just became a writer. I probably worked harder on it than I remember. John Horton and Richard Foster were doing, you know, a DNAD evening. And it was my job to put the chairs out, you know, in the boardroom with the peanuts and things. And I've just put the chairs out. This looks interesting. Sat on one. Stayed on the call. And then they handed the briefs out for the next week, which was, I don't know, we were going Low Howard's Bean or somewhere. So off I went to that one and sort of gradually got a feel for it. And then I'd give up the idea and decided I wanted to be a taxi driver. But gradually I got a book together. And then one of the writers, it never reoccurred to me, I think it was O'Shea, said, look, if you want to be a writer, want to be a creative, you'll have to leave here. I went, oh, what really? He goes, well, they'll still give you packages for EC4. So I just took my book around a couple of places, and Chris Wilkins at Y&R said, oh, we're just about to take on a young art director. We could put you with him. And it really was as simple as that. It was like working in John Lewis in electricals. And then going down the road to work in Selfridges in menswear. And I just became a writer. And that's when I thought, oh, shit, here's an actual brief. Oh, no, I've got to do it now. But you do, you know. And I'll be doing it later on today, all these years later. So, you know, it's been great. It's been fantastic. It's turned out rather well.
Yeah, I was going to say, if anyone reading this wants to hear a really fascinating story about your time as the dispatch guy or the guy who drove the Abbott Mead van. There's a recent story you have of how Sainsbury's became Sainsbury's through David's incredible advertising. Well, David and Richard and John's incredible advertising that's on Campaign's website. So I'd urge anyone to go and check that out, because it's a brilliantly written, of course, but it's a really fascinating story of how you know, the whole world of food in this in the UK changed on the back of David's incredible Sainsbury's ads. So
Sainsbury's and all supermarket ads were just you know, a black and white page in the Daily Express with all the special offers. And it's when I first went there, it coincided. A lot of the things I had to do is my duties were putting the proofs away, the proofs of the ads. I think Dave Dye's got most of them now. But you had to file them away. There was no internet. So you'd order, the ads would run in the newspapers, and then you'd order copies of the ad, all nice and glossy, from the printer, from the block maker, and you'd put them away in these big envelopes. And I'd be down in the basement for ages sometimes, because those ads, not just Sainsbury's, Volvo as well, were so well written. And it sounds conceited comparing myself to David Abbott, but I thought I could probably do this one day if it was an accessible style of writing. And what I hadn't realised, what I realise now, is that old saying: easy reading, hard writing. Mm. You know, that rhythm, that fluidity, that flow that Abbott had, and all good copywriters had. And another reason I thought I'd never do it is I know I'm not terribly well read. At school, I used to be bored shitless by things like Virginia Woolf and Dickens Thomas and Shakespeare Hardy, to a certain extent. And I remember saying to Richard Foster, who's a fabulous writer, and I just said, I don't think I can do this. I've never really got into Dickens. I know it sounds childish, but I find it boring. He goes, oh, me too. I said, really? He said, oh, yeah. He said, you know who my favourite writer is? He said, Roald Dahl. Really? Because he can write for children, he can write for adults, he picks his market, he never wastes a word, he's got a wonderful compression of thought, he knows how to tell a story, grammatically and syntax, everything's all perfect, just have a look at it. And it's true, it's that easy reading, hard writing. Bill Bryson's another one. You know, you think it's easy to knock that out, and it's not, it so isn't. And once Richard had said that, I thought, well, maybe I'll have a go at this, and so I did. It was all I could ever do. Like, my wife would attest, I'm an entirely useless human being. I can't put a shelf up. I can barely boil an egg. But I could always type. I could always write stories. So made a living out of it, amazingly.
Yeah, the Sainsbury's thing is really fascinating. And also the not having to be particularly well-read thing makes a lot of sense to me, because one of the first things I ever did at Abbott Mead was do a DPS Sainsbury's campaign when it was still, I can't remember if it was, half of it had gone to M&C and half of it was still there. But all I did until my eyes bled was go through old DNADs from about 1986, 87, 88 and read the old Sainsbury's ads. And I noticed David would always put a little bit in brackets somewhere, and there'd be this... It was great because I had a tone of voice already to go off. It wasn't like I had to start from scratch, but it did feel like you're kind of these giant footsteps, which, you know, my tiny little feet could possibly stay in for a little bit. But... yeah, that Sainsbury's campaign was incredible.
And as we said before, people couldn't believe it. You'd have a double page spread, beautifully written with a lovely photograph of just a bottle of Sainsbury's wine or some cheese or something, which wasn't expensive. You go to Sainsbury's and it would be Sainsbury's prices, not Harrods prices. And it did so much to democratise good food. You know, food before that was crap. It was Finder's crispy pancakes. And right to this day, things like Bake Off and MasterChef and Borough Market and things that we sort of, farmers markets, the things we take for granted now, it all started there. It really did. I saw it with my own eyes. And that, I'm not saying, hey, I realise how advertising can affect cultural change, but I did realise what a difference it can make. You know, it's all about raising awareness. And that's all we do. You know, we raise awareness of things. People can be a bit snippy about it, but if something's going on, something quite innocent like Sainsbury's cheese or a Volvo car, why shouldn't you let people know about it? I know that's a simplistic and idealistic view of advertising, but that's basically what it is, raising awareness. And the other thing it is, it's two things: simplify and exaggerate. I remember someone told me that's all we do, simplify and exaggerate. And when you see every single ad ever, that's all it's done, really, you know, distilled it down and then exaggerated the point to ram it home. That's all we do. Pathetic, really.
Yeah, oh dear, how depressing. Yeah. Okay, well, just going back to your career path. So you're at Y&R now. What happens next?
Well, I'm there and I'm a young copywriter. I was paired with somebody called somebody, it sounds really rude, an art director called Ray Knox, who was from Belfast. And again, I've said before, he thought Sainsbury's was like Fortnum and Mason's. They didn't have Sainsbury's in Northern Ireland. He'd only seen the ads in DNAD. And he comes over to London to work and is astonished that it's just a supermarket. I just did the standard things. But in those days, you served, you didn't realise you were serving it, but it was an apprenticeship. They give you little trade ads and you know, you couldn't believe that you'd see something you'd written. I remember staying at it for ages. And I can't remember, it was for 3-in-1 oil some trade journal. You just think, I wrote that. It's been published. Look, it's in a magazine. And gradually you get a chance to do more press ads and posters and then eventually some TV. TV, I realised how much can go wrong. Not wrong, but from your script to the day it's delivered, the day it's on the screen. The first TV ad I ever did was for Cadbury's Whisper. And again, it was a campaign sort of set by Chris. It was an early thing with celebrities. And the one I had was with Victoria Wood. And again, I've worked with a lot of comedians over the years, and they're not much fun. I think the kindest thing I can say about them is their humour bar is raised a little higher than ours. So it takes more to make them laugh. That will be miserable. And I did it. And I remember I had some mates around. I said it in my, because I knew you knew when it was on. And say, I'm making this up, it's in the middle of Coronation Street. So look, my ad's on now. And there was sort of a polite sort of half titter, but nobody laughed. Nobody thought it was particularly good. Then I realised it wasn't that good, really. Something had been lost. The client had done this and done that. And so I was just always a little more careful after that, just to try and make it how it ought to be. And I always found that easier to do with radio. There was less interference. It was purer. I remember someone saying that if you're a writer, radio's the purest form. There's no interference. Nothing exists unless you write it down. And so I used to veer towards that because I could. The finished result was more how I imagined it. And if it was brilliant, everyone would say, "Oh, that's fantastic." And if it wasn't, I didn't mind taking the whole blame. But what we don't like is when something we've done, something we've created, hasn't turned out well through somebody else's, I suppose, fault or input is the right word. And a lot of the early TV I did at Wine, I was a bit like that. And then I had a couple of moves. I went to a place called Mavity Gilmore, which actually had a very good creative department, but we didn't realise it at the time. I worked with a bloke called Don Barclay, young Tony Barry, who went on to great things as a copywriter and as a director. He was in production like I was, and he said, "Oh, if you do it, I'm sure I could." And I went, "Oh, yeah, right." And he did. He did really well. Then Wilkins and Davis from Y&R formed an agency called Davis Wilkins, and I went there for a while. I think you just sort of move around, people offer you more money, and advertising, even to this day, doesn't really reward loyalty. And then I got a call to go to BNP, and that was like coming home. That was like going back to Abermead. The creative standards were high, the people were brilliant, and I was there for years. People always think I just did radio, but I did a lot of telly. Again, usually with people off the telly. I did a lot of the Barclaycard ads with Rowan Atkinson, did most of those. British Gas with Mrs. Merton and Malcolm. Oh, yeah. I did. Should I be the first one to say it? I'm going to say it live, and it's heresy, and I mustn't, but I will. I did the Jack D ads for John Smith's Bitter, and John Webster nicked them off me. But he must have heard rumours. He used to work to John, and the next thing you know, he was doing them. And he would add to your idea, and I've got to be honest, it wouldn't be exactly the same, he'd nick it. But he would just sort of take it on. But the terrible thing was you didn't find your name alongside his idea. And anyone who denies that is a liar. And I was very fond of Webster. He was very much like Woody Allen. And I think Dave Trott said he didn't quite realise where he got the ideas from. So the jury's out on that. but he was still a genius. And I spent 15 years in the office opposite his. And there was just brilliant people there. But that was hard because, again, it's going back such a long time, people don't remember, but this is about 1989. The agency had actually merged with a lesser agency called Davidson Pierce. Yeah. And I was a... I was brought in by Patrick Hollister to work with an art director who'd been at Davies and Pierce. Now, when you got there, BNP and Davies and Pierce were like two separate agencies. It was almost like the Berlin Wall. And I was working on the Davies and Pierce side with an art director called Sue. And I might as well have gone to work at Davies and Pierce. I wasn't getting any of the Webster. I wasn't getting any of the Frank Budgeon. I wasn't getting all the things I'd come for. And again, because I've been a traffic man, all traffic men know each other, even now. You know, I really miss that life where they were called Les and Stan. And this one was called Keith Sands. I said, Keith, have you got any work? I'm just doing this stuff, this Davies and Pierce stuff. And he goes, well, there's a Guardian radio brief. He goes, but it's in Frank's group, Frank Budgeon's, because it's the Guardian. I said, well, we're all in the same agency. He goes, oh, no. He goes, I'll go over and ask him. And he comes back and he goes, now, Frank says he wants to keep it in his group. And I, without being stroppy, I thought, oh, does he? So I went round and I said, are you Frank Budgeon? And if anyone knows Frank, it was like Boo Radley from To Kill a Mockingbird. Frank, what? And I said, and I was very polite. I said, I'm Paul Burke. I'm from the other side of the Berlin Wall. I'd like to do your Guardian radio brief. And Frank didn't say very much. And I sort of preempted. I said, look, I know you don't know me from Adam, but I've got a cassette here with my radio commercials. So I've done a lot with Wilkins. And he goes, I said, if you like them, will you play them? If you like them, can I do the brief? Imagine that, pitching for a job in an agency you already work at. So I left it with him. And he obviously played. He comes back about an hour later. But Frank would appear like a ghost at the door. And he said, yeah, that's quite good. You can do it. And what it was it was an ad every single day for The Guardian. And you had to write them in the morning. With the story that they wanted to feature in the morning. Write them as soon as you got them. Then record them sort of 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon to be on the air the next day. Again, no emails. And so I started them. And Frank was supposed to approve them. But he was famously elusive, Frank Budgeon. And I could never find him. And in the end, the accounts go, look, we clients approved it. We've got to record it. So I just used to record them. And when they were all done, I went and found Frank and said, I've done them all. And he goes, oh, they're good. And they got a couple of words. One of them got in the book. And BNP merged with DDB. They fired everyone from the Davies and Pierce side except me. I was then welcomed into the good side. And I hadn't done it for that. I'd done it because I was bored and I liked doing radio. But apparently I found out years later that Frank, when they were going through the list of people, because it's a brutal business to get rid of, Frank Budgeon apparently said, oh no, keep him, it'll be good for the ads with no pictures. So they kept me, and that's what I did. So all these nice people and these sort of famous people were very good to me. And that's why I was trying to be good to other people, because boy, God, did I get a few leg ups along the way. And I think when people get older, they tend to forget that. But no, happiness is gratitude. That's all it is. Happiness is gratitude. And I was grateful for everything they did. And grateful for a life that advertising gives you. Now, it is good fun. You're not down a salt mine. You're not even working at BT and living in Leighton Buzzard. You know, you're having a nice time, generally. So I love it. Still do. You've got to be enthusiastic about it.
Absolutely. I mean, you touched on it a little bit before. I think a lot of people, if we're going to be honest about this, consider radio to be the, let's say, ginger stepchild of the four media that were available at the time you were working, the time I started. There's probably even more ginger stepchildren now that exist in the digital world. But I get what you're saying about having more control over it. But you also seem to have a bigger interest in radio beyond that. I'm just having read bits of your blog. You seem to have an interest in the whole world of radio. Do you think those two things sort of came together, having the control over the process and some sort of latent love of the medium itself?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Because I outlined a few of the things that I'm useless at, i.e. cooking. And I realise I've been talking a lot. I'm just going to have a gulp of water. I realised that I went into advertising because I wanted to be a journalist. I went into advertising to write. And yeah, of all the things I'm useless at, I think drawing, anything artistic, you'd think it was done by somebody who was sort of mentally challenged with their left hand, if I showed you anything I drew. And it's a miracle that I'm in a business that has anything to do with art. And I think because I'm so bad at that, I would always veer towards anything that required writing. I still like doing it. I like doing website copy. I do anything like that. I just like playing with the words. And radio gave you the best opportunity. And again, if I'm honest, a lot of people wanted to be footballers. You know, the dream job. I could have been a taxi driver, you know. But other things, I'm not saying I couldn't do, but my dream job. I wanted to be Roger Scott on Capital Radio. Just being a DJ. I don't mean the sort of DJ they have now. You don't have them anymore. A bloke who went into a radio station, I suppose you do to a certain extent on smaller stations, and just played records and talked. And I think by the time I got to an age where I might have been able to be Roger Scott on Capital Radio, there wasn't Roger Scott, there was Pat Sharp. It all become a bit Nathan or Dr. Fox. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And I did. I always, through those years, I always DJed. I DJed in clubs. And, of course, gave it up just as it became really fashionable and really lucrative. I think being a DJ does put you off the human race, because people always say to me, oh, you can do my wedding, or can you do my 21st? And I didn't realise what they were saying, but they'd go, it'd be great, you'll know everyone. You think, oh, shit, that makes it worse. You know, I'm on the other side of the decks. And the people are having a great time. They think you were great, you should play great records, and it. That's the fun bit. They weren't there when I was lugging the great big speakers up the steps to my, you know, to my flat. So, yeah, I always had an interest in radio. I still go on the radio every now and again. I just think it's the most natural medium. You know, I know we're on Skype, but when people hear this, they're just going to hear it orally. They're not going to see it. If you've got a bit of gossip for someone, you phone them up. You don't send them a 48 sheet poster. I just think it's the most natural way of doing things. And also it suits my attention span. And people come in, you know, you could always meet women you fancy and men you admire, and they'll come in and read out your stuff. But no, it's a medium I love, because it's always going to die. Television was going to kill it off. Cinema was going to kill it off. Video was going to kill it off. DVDs, the internet, they never do, because it's the only medium with which you can engage when you're driving the car, painting the ceiling. Not like painting the ceiling in my life, but that's why it never really dies, and that's why I still like doing it. I really do. I'd spend my life doing radio if I could, but it's changed a bit now. It's gone even further down the list, and the reason radio commercials are so bad, quite frankly, quite truthfully, is because they tend to recruit copywriters from art colleges. Mm. So you know, radio commercials now are written by people who are writing them because they were good at drawing at school. It's that true. So they do art A-level, they go to art college, they've got the advertising course, they're very good, they get a partner, they go and get a placement, they get a job, all because they were good at drawing, and rightly so. And then the radio brief comes and they don't want to do it. And I actually don't blame them. That's not what they went into the business for. So it's given to the juniors, the people least able to crack it. It's never very good, or even worse, it's done by the in-house copywriters. I use the term lightly, in radio stations. And it's a real shame, because it should be given to the people that that are best equipped to write. And going back to Abbott Mead, David Abbott, when he was chairman and creative director of the best agency in town, used to write radio commercials. And the first ones I went to, he took me along to record Volvo ads, you know, and I watched it being done. And he was still doing it, because as a writer, and Rossiter was the same, and Chris O'Shea was the same, they got a chance to write. So, yeah, it's still my favourite medium, the one with which I have the most fun, I think.
Yeah, I think it's probably changed a little bit now because of podcasts, because of what you might want to have got in the past. You can find, you know, all sorts of amazing things and people on podcasts. I also have the privilege of being over here and having Howard Stern to listen to every day, who's out, just, if you listen to it and you're conscious of what he's doing in a 4-hour long show and the preparation and things that go into it. I mean, he's the sort of consummate radio star, I guess, of the last however many years in America.
I would say ever.
Yeah. And he's still absolutely brilliant. And it's still amazing to hear him speak about some of the things he speaks about. But one thing I was going to ask, actually, in the context of radio, was the Budweiser frog spots. So they were at least nominated or got pencils for you at that time. What was the story behind you doing those? Because obviously that was a continuation of a TV campaign from America.
It was a continuation of a TV campaign from America. and the voices were just brilliant. But they had the frogs as sort of heavy, sort of quite gangstery. But I'm not saying they weren't funny, but they were slightly chilly. And I just changed the characters slightly. There was one with a really big, deep voice. And instead of being menacing, I made him, couldn't give a shit. He just had the most amazing deep voice. I can't remember, his name was Danny something. Went out to New York to record them. And I expected a big fat bloke in his 60s, instead of which he was quite young, probably 30, 32, thin and very good looking. You thought, oh God, it's not fair. You've got a lovely deep voice as well. So we made him like he couldn't give a shit. Yeah, yeah, whatever, Louis. And Louis, there was always one at school, I won't name him in case he listens to this, but who wants to be one of the lads and isn't. Yeah, I'm doing that. And I made Louis a bit more like that and just changed the characters because everything comes out of the characterisation. When you're writing anything, it's whether that person would say that. And so I made him more desperate to be, you know, not tough, but just tough, just desperate to impress. And Frank, who was the deep voice one, just made him more laid back, couldn't give a shit, yeah, whatever, Louis. And just changed it slightly. And then I found it easy. I did it for my own benefit. I found it easier to write. And they went very well. I remember they got Pick of the Week in campaign, and it said, yes, an American campaign done by Goodby Silverstein in wherever they were, adapted by Paul Berg. Oh, well, adapted, is that it really? And they were very popular. And in the end, they ran our ones from the UK in the US. Oh, I still love doing those. Because there was ISDN, but I insisted we went out to New York to record them because we were doing 10 of them. And I thought by the time we've got the different studios and flights aren't expensive. And there's just something about, again, when you're doing radio, when you're doing anything, meeting the person, shaking hands and saying, hello, how are you? And having a nice chat, putting them at their ease, then putting you at your ease, and you'll get a better performance. But had we done it by ISDN to people we've never met, I don't think we'd have got the good performances and I don't think they'd have got the awards they did. But yes, it was somebody else's idea. But, you know, ideas have to evolve. And it was just such fun to do, to go out to America to do radio. But there's so many things you can do with radio that make it. The one tip I'd give anyone, I'll give you two tips for writing good radio, but one for writing them and one for getting a good performance. The writing one is the first thing you do is give your characters names. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a book or a film or a screenplay where every character is called MBO and FBO? It's just the first thing you do. So you think of the bloke and you think, oh, he'd be called Rob, and her, probably Lucy. And the moment you call them Rob and Lucy, immediately you can see a sort of face and a sort of age. You can see what they sound like, what they look like, how old they are, their relationship. And the moment you do that, they become real people. Then it's MBO and FBO. And they will, this sounds so pretentious, but they will help you write your script because they're real people. Rob would probably say that, to which Lucy would say that. And then when you're in the studio, when you've done it, you've got exactly one. Yeah, go there, whoever. Yeah, that's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Thank you, we've got everything right. Listen, just before you go, will you do it the way you think it ought to be? You know what we're trying to do. Don't swear. Keep it to about 30 seconds. Just do it the way you think the book. And 9 times out of 10, their performance will be better than your one. They'll just do something. They'll say it in a funny way. They'll add a word. And that, honestly, I'd urge anyone to do it. Not always, I must admit. Sometimes it's exactly the same as yours and sometimes it goes wrong. But I'd say, yeah, 9 times out of 10, it's better than your one. So do that.
Yeah, I found that it was immensely the case when I worked, because I did a lot of spots with Simon Pegg for BT back in the early 2000s.
And did you do that? There was a radio quiz. He's on. He's the quiz master. I'm sure it was Simon. He's brilliant. I won't use him because he's got a difficult agent. Not wait, it's just more problems.
Well, I mean, I was going to say there were a lot of, like David Schneider as well. There were a lot of really fantastic people I worked with, and it was like you were saying, you know, if you think someone's amazing and brilliant, it's easier to get them in for a radio ad than for anything else. And you know, whether it was Terence Stamp or Patsy Kensit or whoever, you could just spend an hour with them, and that was great. But I was wondering who were your favourites to work with over the years?
Oh God, I mean, it's so obvious. I think people become your favourites and then everybody gets into them. I mean, I remember using, I'd seen this bloke in the secret policeman's ball, and I had to find out his name. He was young, but he seemed old at the same time, and his name was Stephen Fry. And I gave him his first voice ever. He'd be one of my favourites. Again, they've all become quite big names. Rob Brydon was another. And Rob Brydon, we all knew in advertising because he was the person you went to for sort of different voices. If you didn't have much money for your thing, or it was a pitch and you needed two people, but you just wanted one person to play them, don't you pay? And so you thought they were two different people, but and you wouldn't know it's the same person. Rob Brydon was one of that. Lewis McLeod, who is finally getting the recognition he deserves over here, is fantastic. Steve First is another one. A lot of them are more anonymous. But people often say, we want a celebrity voice. And I remember doing this for Sainsbury's. Oh, we want a famous voice. So I got them 10 voices out, but I didn't put their names on them. I put voice one, voice two. And these were famous people. I had Judi Dench, I had Idris Elba, Dawn French, loads of people. Nobody recognised them. They recognised Graham Norton, I think, and Barbara Windsor, who are so distinctive.
Yeah.
So, just get the best person for the job. Don't necessarily get a famous person. Because the moment you... it's such a mistake with radio. If you did get a famous person, unless you've got Barbara Windsor playing Barbara Windsor or Graham Norton, for a reason that you want Graham Norton, the moment you hear the radio commercial, I think this is a mistake with Hollywood as well when they put actors on animated stuff. You don't see the character. You say, oh, there's Stephen Fry. So in your head, you see Stephen Fry, where you don't see the person he's playing in the radio commercial. You know, like Shrek, the moment I knew the donkey was Eddie Murphy, I sort of saw Eddie Murphy playing the part, and I didn't see the donkey. So I just think it's your thing. You invent it, you cast it, and there's hundreds of them out there, really, really good actors. And you think you can do it, and you go behind the mic, and what you've got in your head never comes out that way. A lot of people think they can do it as well. I mean, this bloke phoned me up, he goes, hello, you could have been. As soon as they gave me your number, I'd like to get into voiceovers. And I remember I've got the standard way of getting rid of them now. I said, so what do you do at the moment? He goes, well, I work in the city. I'm an analyst. And I went, oh, so you've got a job. And then it's quiet. And I said, look, you have got a nice voice, but it's no nicer than all the actors and people that I use. People that have sacrificed everything to go to drama school to do this for a living. And if you want to do that, I'd adopt the same attitude to you. I'm obviously going to favour them because they don't work in the city as analysts, and that seems to shut them up. people. It's one of the things people think they can do it. Having a good voice isn't even half of it, you know. It's having the tune, it's taking direction, it's recognising what to do. It's like the same with ads generally, he says, moving on to something. I don't think the idea is even half of it. Any sort of ad, any piece of work you do, yes, it's got to have an idea, but the idea, people go, it's all about the idea. Well, it's not. The thing I always cite is Ricky Gervais going to the BBC and said, we've got a sitcom, what's it about? Oh, it's about this really dull bloke. It's called The Office, yeah. Dull bloke, what happens? Well, not much. Works in this dull office among dull people. You know, it's not going to go very well, that meeting. It's about the writing, it's about the casting, it's about the crafting. And I think people have got too hung up on the fact that it's all about the idea, and it's not. You know, it's the idea and then what comes on top of it. Sounds really obvious, but I don't think people take the time to write things properly and art direct them properly and just make them gorgeous. And the people you've been talking to and the people you feature, I'm hesitating to include myself, but are people that do make, you know, Dave Dye's obsessive, and I've worked with Dave. I had this line and he comes back. I just did one ad and I couldn't even see the top. I was like, what is this shit? What have you done to my head? Of course, it gets in DNAD for typography. And I look at it now, and it's really, it took ages doing it. Mark Reddy's another one. They take forever. Well, not forever, but they spend the time necessary to make something look different and make it look cool. And that's why they are where they are. You know, they've got an idea, but they build heavily on top of that idea. And that's why I salute them. Great. Yeah. And when you see that sort of craftsmanship, you see good writing. You know, I saw it as a kid. In looking at all the proofs that David Abbott written and Richard Foster and Chris O'Shea. And I still see it now and it still delights me.
Yeah, I think you'd actually be hard pushed to say what the idea was for Sainsbury's back in those days. It was almost more of a strategy of elevating food and making it seem like, you know, and then David writes it and you get the incredible art direction from Ron Brown. But an idea like Happiness is a Cigar Called Hamlet or Heineken Refreshes the Parts, that's not really in there. And yet you have an amazing, amazing campaign. that doesn't have what we would conventionally call a concept. And but the execution is so amazing that you're not sitting there going, hang on, where's the idea here? So
yeah, you know. I think you nailed it when you said the strategy was the idea. And I always think it was what if people forget, because I think Sainsbury's fell apart, I put in that article, because when I went back to Avonmead, I went back there, I left to write books, and I came back 23 years later. And it was a bit like romantically going back out with your first girlfriend, only to discover she's fat, ugly, and doesn't really love you anymore. So it's a bit like that. So it was very different. And Sainsbury's wasn't about the craft. It was about, it's that fatal thing. It just drives me mad that you have to talk down to people, that they won't understand you unless you use a regional accent or a Cockney accent or something, that they won't understand you. And they do. You know, for want of a better word, working class people, they love Downton Abbey. They love that sort of thing. You go on the football terraces, people are as rough as hell, but they're funny and they're witty and they're intelligent, just in a different way. And I think what Sainsbury's did that isn't spoken about as often as it is they spoke to ordinary people in, if you like, an upmarket way, and made and treated them with respect and told them you can have lovely food too, and this food is really nice, and this is where you get it, and you can afford it. And that's why they were so brilliant. And people don't do that now. You know, you just hear that voice, you know, that sort of northern voice. Why would you use a northern, if a bloke's got a great voice or a great accent and he's northern, of course you use him, he's brilliant. But don't just use him because his voice is sort of proletarian. It's a real mistake. And I think that's what Sainsbury's did, you know. It just wasn't the same anymore. You don't have to make anything complicated and highfalutin, but just people will understand. And you've been in meetings yourself, I'm sure you have. The client goes, "Yes, I'm not sure people will understand that." I remember saying to this, I didn't really mean to be quite so rude to this woman's client. I said, "Did you understand it?" "Oh, yes." And you think, and then I let it hang for a minute. You know, like, well, you're as thick as shit, and you understand it. But yeah, that's the way it is. But no, I did give it all up to write books. Am I talking about that?
Well, I thought we might do a book one separately, because there's probably quite a lot to say, and you and I, having been published authors, could possibly roll that around for an hour all on its own.
Well, I just want to say now that I admired you. There's two people I admire in this business for that. There's you and there's Meg Rosoff, because you both, when I did my books, honestly, we might cut this out and use it another time, but it's true. Everyone in the business said, "Oh, I think I'll write a book. I bet you got it as well." The subtext being, "I thought you had to be clever, but if you've written one, you clearly don't." And you and Meg, I remember you telling me we were doing something, and you were writing something with your wife called "Fuck Me Backwards," and you were going to write a book. And I thought, no, this bloke's actually going to do it. And Meg was the same. She goes, "Right." She says, "If you can do it, I'm going to do it. It's giving me a kick up the ass." But so many people, I'd love to name them.
Well, it's a kind of perpetual cliche of advertising copywriters that you've all, you know, I think it was Peter Cook who said, there was that joke where someone goes, "I'm writing a book." "Oh yes, neither am I."
Do you know something? If only that were true, because I think it fell apart. I'm not going to say, it's not the same as it was. But when I started, you had the writer and the art director. You combined your complementary skills to create, you know, you're really good at the writing, you're really good at the art. You know, David Abbott and Ron Brown and John Horton and Richard Foster, classic examples. Their roles were quite clear. So I'm not saying Richard never had a suggestion for a picture or John never changed a line. Of course they did, but that's what they did. But it's when creatives go, "Oh, we both do a bit of each."
Yeah.
You think, well, who's responsible for the copy then? So it was always the case that copywriters, myself included, always wanted to write a book or had a book inside them. I just wish it was the case now, because the ones I come across can barely write their own name. And I think that's the difficulty we've got now. But again, the thing I'm not allowed to say, but I think it's true, is the standard of, I can be shattered down for this and there'll be examples to the contrary, but the general standard of young creatives isn't brilliant. Because I just wonder whether, if there's a place called Creative School, I'm making it an imaginary place called Creative School, and people from Creative School, the top people used to go into advertising because it was the coolest thing to do, and I'm not sure it is anymore, so that I don't know what they're doing, whether it's web design or filmmaking or that sort of thing, or designing apps or designing games. It's not something I know about, but someone has to write and art direct all those fantastic video games, so maybe they're doing a bit of that, and I'm just wondering whether the top ones are being creamed off for other things. and advertising is now getting the ones who aren't so good. Well, I don't know what it is, but I don't know. Don't seem to see the enthusiasm for writing and for art direction. For writing and for art, that was usually when I first started in the books I used to see.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That needs to be addressed.
Well, the problem is, I think it's going to be an ever-decreasing circle where if you lose the final generations of people who both care about it and are very good at it, who's anyone going to learn from if they have that information?
Apologies, but at this point the sound quality got a bit strange, but just to clarify the upcoming comments Paul was about to make, they're about John Field, who when I was at Abbotmead, Vickers was head of traffic, but Paul was talking about him in very positive terms as someone who taught him the value of kindness and politeness. So I'll let Paul pick that up now.
I think before I even began, he taught me, without realising it, to sort of behave, to stay calm, never to panic. And I don't think I have, others might disagree, I don't think I've ever been a creative prima donna. And I think that's because I wouldn't like John to see me behaving like a wanker. So that was the very first thing. And for the writing, if you wanted to be a copywriter, which I didn't realise I did, but I did, David Abbott was a great help for hiring me in the first place and for sort of teaching me little bits and pieces. Chris O'Shea always taught me a good thing with writing is if you've got a problem, you're going along with your copy and you sort of, you come to a bit of a full stop, you've got a problem, you can't make that line work. He said, almost always, it's the line before that's the problem. Go back, change all that, and then the next one will drop into place and you've solved it. And I actually think that's a metaphor for life. The thing that's pissing you off isn't usually the thing that's... Say someone cuts you up and you yell out the window, "Hey, fuck it!" It wasn't actually the motorist. It's because you're in a bad mood about something else.
Yeah.
Maybe you had a row with your wife or something. It's usually the thing before that stops you doing the thing you're trying to do. And that was a very good thing. The other thing, I think it's Richard Foster, it's very a good idea to turn something into a question. I remember writing a line for Volvo, blah, 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 at £6,840. You can't afford not to, you can't afford not to buy one. And Chris said, just turn it into a question, blah, 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 £6,975. Can you afford not to? Just let the person finish it off. You know, once you've told someone you can't afford not to, can you afford not to? You know, so he was a great influence. Chris Wilkins, again, was a big star, sort of too young. He was a big star at BNP, then went to Y&R, and just a very, very funny man. Again, he wrote books as well, just knew how to write, just how to cut things. John Lloyd, I'd have to say John Lloyd. I did Bartley Card and I did Mrs. Merton. John's just a person. He comes out of Cambridge, invents the news quiz. Then he goes on and produces Spitting Image and Blackadder, Have I Got News For You?
And Not Now Got News.
Then he goes into advertising, which Ryan met him, he directs commercials for me. And then he sort of disappears for a while and invents QI. John was very good with characterisation. He'd say things like, doesn't matter what a character looks like, as long as you... Because we had a line with Mrs. Merton and I thought, oh no, a mother wouldn't, she wouldn't say that to him. And John said, look, the audience believe this young woman is dressed up as an old woman is real. She can sort of say what she likes. And it's that sort of thing. Mandy Wheeler, I did those first Guardian ads with, who was, they don't really have them anymore, sort of an independent radio specialist. And she taught me a lot about casting, about, just about radio, and instilled in me a love of the medium. Just so, so lucky along the way. And then just people, I mean, BNP, it was a very, I loved it. And you'd come in and look at people's work and say, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't change that. I used to do it to people all the time. They used to do it to me. And I just think being around people along that corridor, you had Nick Gill, you had Tony Davis and Tony Kim, you had Jeremy Cragen and Jeremy Carr, just Paul Gay and Steve Reeves, Frank Budgeon was over there, Webster was over there, Tony Cox was wonderful. Much underrated, Tony Cox. He was a great creative director. He used to let you get on with it. I mean, I showed him a script once when he first joined. And I showed him the radio script and he said, do you think it's any good? And I went, well, yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have shown it to you. He goes, yeah, you look after the radio now. And again, that was a very good lesson. You know, I thought, oh, shit, I'm responsible for it now. It better be really good. I just can't blame anyone else. And it was just full of those sort of people. And I'm still meeting them now. And younger people, you know, as you get older, you must teach and you must learn, because they know stuff you don't. And it doesn't necessarily have to be about social media or apps or things like that. It might just be a film that they've seen that you haven't heard of, and go and see it. Again, I think it was Abbott that said it's so true about anything. There's no output without input. And again, I've instilled this into my kids. We always go and see stuff. And again, not necessarily highfalutin stuff, but exhibitions, go and see films, go and see the theatre. You know, for casting with radio particularly, you know, listen to radio, watch the telly, go to the theatre, find those people. And I just think it's the best thing you can do, because it's all around you. You don't reinvent anything. You just find it and pluck it out of the air and put it together. And that's what you do in any creative endeavour. And there's always people around that will tell you stuff, advise you on things.
So when you were at DDB, you left. Was there a particular plan to go into more of the production side of radio there, or did you go and be a creative somewhere else?
Apologies again, but the sound levels went a bit crazy again. I'd like to find the makers of Audacity and shove my laptop up their asses. Anyway, Paul's just in the middle of telling a story about how when he was at BMP or DDB, he was offered 2.5 times his salary to go and move to JWT and become a creative director. So we'll let Paul pick up that story now.
I remember saying to Tony Cox, I said, I wrote them a letter of resignation, just so that working at BMP, working at DDB, is a luxury I can no longer afford. It was true, I had a second child on the way. And so I went to JWT, and they were very nice. I'm not going to slag them off in any way at all, but it wasn't for me. Oh, my God. All I did was sit in meetings. I was on that, you know, I was on the path to becoming an ECD, if so many people take. And I sat in meetings. I wasn't doing any work. I had a group of 6 people, and I just didn't like it. But I thought, my God, I've got a baby on the way. I've got all this money. I was on the Jaguar account. I had a Jaguar XJR, which is always, working class boys of a certain generation, they always want a Jag. Yeah. And once I got my Jag, took my mum down to Sainsbury's and Ladbroke Grove in it, and then I didn't want my Jag anymore. And I just thought, what can I do? And in the end, Larry Barker had taken over as creative director, so I'm very grateful to him. Larry's a very good writer. So Larry phones up and goes, look, we're not getting the radio done. We'd like to have you back. Obviously, we can't match that salary, but can we meet you halfway? So that was still a massive pay rise from what I'd been on before. And I managed to sort of pay off my debt or go back to BNP. But when I went back, it was to work by myself and to do the radio. And I had a producer called Caroline Prickett. And that lasted, well, the agency wasn't what it was. It lost a lot of accounts. They didn't really need, the accounts on which we did radio sort of disappeared. They lost them, British Gas and Sony and this and that. There were loads of them. And so I took the chance to go off and write books, saying, I'm never coming back. I'm off to be a novelist. Fuck off the lot of you. But that's for part two. I did have to come crawling back a few years later.
So you left DDB and you did the book writing, but obviously you're still in the agency world now. And I remember when I was at AMV, you were a sort of all-purpose radio producer, director, caster, writer. Yeah. Then how did that end up being the next stage?
Well, completely, just like you, it's don't give up your day job. My agent said to me, I always remember it. I think it was 97% of published authors, the ones whose books you see on the table in Waterstones, still do something else for a living. So it was better to be freelance. And I just thought, well, radio is what I'm best known as and what I enjoy. So I just set myself as Paul Burke Radio. And I found myself getting more work for producing other people's. Like, you would come to me and say, well, who should we have for this? And we'd do it together. I got more work producing other people's scripts than I did writing mine. Sometimes I can either do the whole lot or as little as you want. So I just kept going. It's a good job I did, because you don't make money out of it. You make a few bob to start with, but it's not enough to sustain yourself unless you're J.K. Rowling. So it's a very good job I kept going. And now I just think it's a lot more splintered. I think if you're a creative person in any sort of creative endeavour, freelance is the natural state to be. You know, actors and playwrights and novelists, they find it hard that if you're a real creative person, would you work for this? You're yoked to one employer, to this great big corporation. And so it does feel more more natural. And I don't think I'd have felt this way before the invention of laptops and the internet, because we, you know, you can work anywhere, and people do, and I do enjoy that freedom. You get the odd day, you think, shit, I've got no work, everyone hates me, I'll never work again, and then somebody phones up that afternoon and something happens, and you have to trust it. It's like if you had a shop, there's no guarantee anyone will ever go in your shop ever again, but they sort of do, and it's the same with freelance work. So, yeah, I might do another book, though. I've got a good idea. It's just getting the time to sit down and do it. Because I did four, I had two book deals, and by which time I honestly had no more things in my head. I had nothing. Whoever said everyone's got a book in them, and you know this yourself, everyone's got a leaflet, a little story, but you have to know this much, my arms wide apart, and have that much material, and I'm bringing my arms back in again to write a book that's this big, and people have no idea how much you have to know, how much you have to do, and how hard you have to work in order to do one book. And I did four, and I'm really proud of that, but oh my God, there's nothing left in my head. I'd gone insane by the end of that. So to come back and work with you, Abbott Mead, or I did a lot for Rainey Kelly, and loads of agencies, JWT actually, loads and loads of agencies and direct with clients, was just a blessed relief, because I wasn't so lonely anymore. So I'm happy, it's good. And I'm almost back to being a dispatch boy. It does feel that way. Not so much today because the weather's not great. But, you know, I'd go off on my bicycle and go and meet people and go to meetings. It reminds me very much of riding around town delivering artwork. So, yeah, I haven't progressed in the slightest back where I was, but happy to be there. It's turned out very well.
And is that sort of, you, this is going to just continue as the way you're expecting things to be for the near future, or do you have a plan as to what might be next?
I mean, my first book, Father, oh my God, it's been optioned so many times for a movie, but this time it's getting close. They always say that making a movie in this country is like trying to cook a steak by breathing on it. but that's, you know, that would be great. That's, and I've written the script, because so many people used to get it wrong. And then the last people, that North London Irish Catholic thing is a very particular thing. And people just didn't get it. And the other thing they tried to do in my books is try and over-intellectualise them. Oh, yes, we've got to find out about the struggle and this and that. And my books are actually quite simple. I'm not saying they're thick. I'm not saying they're dumbed down. But going back to Abbott, it's that easy reading, hard writing. I'd work very hard to make them simple and straightforward and make the story flow. And they'd try and sort of add complications. But anyway, the last people just said, no, you write it. But then that was a real, really difficult. Because I thought, that's my book, I'll just turn it into a script. But, of course, a lot of the things that the characters think, they're funny when you think of them. Say, you write the words, Frank thought she was an ugly old cow. That might be funny-ish if he thinks it, but you can't say it out loud. So in a script, you've got to, and a lot of the descriptors have to go, so it's actually much harder than I thought. So I'm now a screenwriter. I've done that, and I'm doing another one. But, yeah, again, it's just typing. That's what I do, just hitting the keys in hopefully the right order. And I do enjoy it, I really do.
Great. So I think we're just around this sort of hour mark, and I feel like we've come somewhere to...
This is like therapy. I'm actually sitting on a sofa and it's talking about yourself.
Well, I've enjoyed it enormously. You know, I think there's loads for people to take out of what you've just said. And there's still, I think, plenty more in the tank, definitely for us to do a chat about what it's like to write a book, having been an advertising creative, and what are the ups and downs of all that. Because I think a lot of people, as you were kind of hinting at earlier, have an idea of what it's like, and they don't have the first fucking clue of what it's like. So we should go into that in a future chat. But thanks very much for today.
That's all right. The best bit for me was writing a book, was going into Webster and waving this book. I said, "You and your DNADs, I'm more famous than you."
I bet you love that.
Yeah, I'd love to chat with you about that, because I will learn something off you about your process, and you know.
And
yeah,
IU.
It will be interesting. We should do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good luck with your... What day is it? Wednesday. Yeah, I'm about to go to bed. You're about to start your day. And
I'm about to write some scripts of Rob Brydon, going back to him
nice.
For cruises today, so that's what I'm doing. I'll miss you now. I want to see when you're coming over.
I don't have any current plans, but when I do, we'll definitely go for a drink or lunch or something like that. Yeah. So cheers, Paul, and we'll talk again soon.
Good night.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.